From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that's thinking about what you are thinking we are thinking about. I'm Michael Crosser, next to me is Chad Silberg, and today's topic is consciousness. Hey, Chad.
What's on your mind, Mike?
Oh, so much.
Want to know what's on mine? I got you thinking about what I'm thinking about.
Wow. You just blew my mind. No. This whole topic is blowing my mind.
Yeah.
We actually got a listener question from a longtime listener, first-time writer, named Troy from Florida. Wants to know, he says, I would love to hear you guys talk about what consciousness is and what it means for a being to be conscious. He wrote into crisscrossingsci@gmail.com, all one word, all lowercase. He could have also written into our page on Facebook. And we love it when people do that because we love to do shows and have cool show ideas.
Yeah.
The more and more I started thinking about it, I was like, this is great.
It's a good idea.
We should
isn't
totally
it?
Do this episode.
Sounds like a great idea.
And then I went to Chad and was like, Chad, we should do this. And you were already like, yeah, I know. I suggested this a month ago.
Yeah. So thank you, Troy.
Yeah, yeah. Troy, you helped me actually listen to my partner here. So,
yeah. So, Mike, what do you think it is?
Well, when I got this question, I immediately started thinking something that often blows my mind when I talk to a lot of biologists, especially microbiologists.
Mm.
You know, recently we had Megan Bestwick in the studio, and she was talking about how we can just tell DNA to just replicate itself so that we can make copies and we can do all the tests that we need to do. And so we have the ability to do all the chemistry that's happening. Basically, it's all just chemistry, that this protein is going over here and doing some chemistry and then moving over here and doing this other thing.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's cool. I can see how that's working out. But then at some point, you kind of build up from there and you're like, well, you've got this cell, this thing that seems to tell itself to do that and seems to know that we should be reproducing and eating and doing all the things that we have to do. Somehow it's knowing all that stuff.
So just the cellular physiology that emerges from basic biochemistry.
That already blew my mind.
You find amazing.
Yes.
And then
you go from there.
Yeah, from there up to an organism, a whole multicellular organism.
Right, because we talked about slime mold not too long ago and how it seems to act like it's got a brain.
Uh-huh.
And yet it's very simple stimuli doing different things.
Yeah.
But then at some point we have to be thinking, because I want to say that I'm a thinking being.
Oh, you are. Yeah, well, I think that's an interesting way to think about it, and that's like sort of like a classic physicist way of approaching it. Like
bare bones,
everything down to the most reductive level possible. How can anything more complicated therefore be happening?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And so I suppose chemistry is sort of like the emergent property of physics, right? And
that is how we think about it.
And,
yeah.
Right.
I tell my students it's a small branch of physics.
And I suppose, does that mean that biology is a small branch of chemistry then? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, must be.
Okay. Well, I'll let that lie. But so when we're talking about something as complex as consciousness, it is this emergent property of the biochemistry that's going on in an organism's brain.
Mm-hmm.
And just because you are an organism with a brain doesn't necessarily mean you would have what we would recognize as consciousness.
Okay.
And so neurobiologists who look at this kind of thing kind of break this up into a couple of different parts that together make up what we would recognize as some being conscious. And that is that it has a part of the brain that leads to arousal of the organism, just, you know, being awake and bringing in sensory information and processing that sensory information and the physiology of the organism being adjusted accordingly. So that's like the arousal portion of it.
And that, like, really any living thing is doing that piece.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But then the other piece is being aware of doing those kinds of things, or being aware of your body and being aware of the sensory input that's coming in.
Hmm.
And so it's basically thinking about thinking, or having an awareness of your awareness, right? It's that next level.
Yeah.
And if you kind of poke around and try to look for brain region diagrams of where consciousness is located, most of the diagrams you find point to the cortex. The cortex is, you know, when you think of a brain and it's all that sort of wrinkly, foldy stuff, right? That's the cortex.
The entire brain.
It's basically most of what people think of when they think of a brain.
Ah, okay.
So, I
was going to make a joke about, their answer is like they just took a crayon and just colored the whole thing outside the lines.
It is slightly more useful than that, but not much. But recently, people have started trying to figure out what regions of the brain and what neural pathways are important for consciousness and what connections within the brain are important for this experience I'm having, that I'm having an experience.
Hmm.
And so, like I said, it's these two phenomena working together, the brain arousing the body and the body thinking about the fact that it's aroused.
It's felt stimulus.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that they're going through, they're giving lobotomies to human subjects.
Actually, some of the research into this area does compare the brain activity in different regions of the brain for people who are comatose versus people who are conscious and awake.
Oh, okay.
And what these researchers found is that there's this region in the brainstem that is responsible for arousal, and there's, I don't want to get into like technical jargony names about it,
mm-hmm.
right? So if like experts in this are listening and they're really annoyed that we're not using the specific terms, I apologize.
Yeah.
So there's this region that's responsible in the brainstem for arousal, and this very specific region in most, but not all, of these comatose patients was damaged. And so it seems like this particular little region is really important for the arousal piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this specific regions in the cortex that prior work had suggested if there are defects or injuries in those regions, then that can also lead to cognitive impairments and lack of consciousness. And those regions have really strong connections to this particular part of the brainstem.
Mm-hmm.
And if those connections are somehow impeded or disrupted, then in all of the patients that had a disruption of those connections, that person would have been one of their comatose patients.
Hmm.
So there's something about the working together of a specific region in the brainstem that's responsible for arousal and a couple of other maybe a couple primary regions in the cortex that are connected to those brainstem regions that are responsible for the awareness of that arousal.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's, you know, instead of like taking a crayon and coloring in the entire cortex now, maybe we're starting to hone in on at least certain segments mm-hmm. of the cortex and certain connections between different parts of the brain. But this is a big area of research that a lot of people are interested in trying to figure out. And one of the things that makes it so complicated is that the brain's really complex.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of neurons with billions and billions of possible connections.
Mm-hmm.
And brains have subtle differences among individuals. And so you might learn a lot about most people from a few people's brains, but then there are always those exceptions who might have a slight little difference. Like I mentioned, most but not all patients that were in a coma had an injury to this part of the brainstem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's with those other people who were in a coma but didn't have that injury?
Hmm.
And what's with the people who did have that injury but were not in a coma? What's different about their brains?
Yeah.
So anyway, that gets at kind of like the neurophys, neuroanatomy of where consciousness resides.
Hmm. Okay, so that's in our brains.
Uh-huh.
It seems like just about any living organism has the arousal part. I mean, even ones that don't have a brain per se, right? I mean, there are some nematodes
yeah,
and things that are very simple, but they're able to perceive stimuli and react to that.
Right.
How complicated do you have to be to actually have the second piece to it, though? Are there other animals that have that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It's interesting to think about what sort of cognitive abilities we share with other kinds of organisms
mm-hmm.
and whether we share that by common descent or if these cognitive abilities arose independently in different lineages.
Oh, yeah.
And so by exploring the different cognitive abilities of different kinds of animals, you can start to get a handle on that kind of thing. One level of awareness, the awareness piece, is what we can call metacognition. This is an ability to think about what you are thinking about. And so in the absence of being able to directly ask somebody if they're thinking about something and
mm-hmm.
what it is that they're thinking about, we have to design experiments to determine whether or not some other animal can demonstrate that it's thinking about what it's thinking or that it knows what it knows.
Right. And, I mean, I'm often asked by people like, oh, what are you thinking? You know, like all the time. I'm like, I don't know.
It's just like little organ grinder with a monkey dancing. And
usually, yeah. Right. Or like maybe my eyes are darting and I'm like, you know, bouncing around from all these different ideas. And it's like, this is like a slot machine. You want me to stop right there? What? I don't know what that was.
Right. I have a bit of the same issue.
Yeah. So I need these tests, I guess.
Yeah. Well, so I've thought about giving exams in a way that would force students to do a little bit of this metacognition to make them think about what they know. And one way to do that would be to give them a question on an exam that says, okay, you can decline to answer the following question. And if you decline to answer the following question, you get 3 points. If you attempt to answer the question and you do so correctly, you get 6 points.
Okay.
If you attempt to answer the question and you do so incorrectly, you get 0 points.
Hmm.
So what would you do if you were approached with that?
What's a passing grade?
70%.
Oh, so I have to answer some to pass.
Uh-huh.
But like I should just leave it blank.
Exactly. And why would you leave it blank?
No, I could see a situation where I think I know something and I should absolutely answer that. But if I'm not totally sure, I'd more likely get some points if I didn't do anything with it.
Yeah. Or if you're like, oh man, geez, I have no idea. I didn't study that part. So I'm just going to take my 3 points and be happy. You and I probably both grew up in the era when we had a lot of standardized tests and you were told, if you don't know, just fill in C.
Well,
just
until they... Well, sure.
Where I grew up, you were told, just guess. It's better to just guess because you have like a 1 in 4 chance of getting the correct answer.
Right.
And so I kind of had it drilled into me that you don't leave stuff blank.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so if I were presented with a problem where I could decline to answer it and still get some points, I would really have a hard time leaving it blank.
Yeah, I can see that.
So
I mean, it's sort of like I was also drilled into me to clean my plate.
Yeah, I had that too. Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm regretting that later in life.
Yeah, yeah. So this sort of taking stock of what you know and then behaving accordingly, that is kind of the first order of thinking about thinking, of consciousness, being aware of what you know. And
so you're saying your students fail that first test?
Well, no, that's not. Don't put words in my mouth. So what I was getting to is that people have done that very study on rats.
Okay.
And basically, they presented the rat with a tone of a certain length, and then they presented the rat with a tone of another length.
Okay.
And the question was, which tone was longer, the first tone or the second tone?
Okay.
And the rat could go one direction and decline to answer the question and get 3 little pieces of kibble.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could go the other direction, and if it pushes this lever, it means that it thought the first tone was longer, and if it pushes the other lever, it means it thought the second tone was longer. And if
hold on, they trained rats to do this?
Yeah, and if it is correct, it gets 6 pieces of kibble, and if it is incorrect, it gets
zapped.
0 pieces of kibble. Now it's it just gets no reward, right?
Okay.
And so this is metacognition. So the rat hears 2 tones.
Mm-hmm.
In sequence, and it has to evaluate, can I discern a difference in length between these 2 tones?
Mm-hmm.
No, I can't. I'm going to take the sure thing. Or, yes, I can. I'm going to go and push one of these 2 levers.
Hmm.
And so when the tones were really different and obviously different in their length, then almost all the rats would go and correctly take the test.
Hmm.
And as the tones became increasingly similar in their duration, therefore more difficult to tell apart, more and more rats would decline to take the test.
Hmm.
But the ones that did try to answer actually did quite well.
Hmm.
And another interesting thing about this experiment is if you take away the ability to choose whether or not to decline or to take the test, if you force everybody to try to answer the question, everybody does okay when the tones are really different in length. But as the tones become more similar in length and therefore more difficult, i.e. this is a harder question, if you force everybody to answer the harder question, then not surprisingly, performance goes down because now you're forcing individuals who don't have the choice to decline, who would have otherwise declined.
Yeah, okay.
So, sure. I mean, you know, maybe that's not surprising, but it also just kind of, again, made me kind of think about how I give exams. Like, is there value in forcing somebody to try to answer a question that they just do not know? And is there value in being able to identify, I just don't know that, so I'm going to set that one aside?
Hmm.
So it's sort of the trade-off between metacognition and actually forcing everybody to answer the questions. But that's sort of off track. But to think about a rat demonstrating that it also has at least that level of an internal mental life, is kind of interesting. So that level of consciousness shows up probably pretty broadly within the mammals.
Hmm. Okay.
Okay, so that's thinking about what you yourself are thinking about. But what about...
And so mammals can do that?
I don't want to say all mammals.
But many mammals can do...
Yeah, it's pretty common.
What about
yeah.
reptiles, birds?
Yeah, we actually have some interesting examples about birds and some interesting things that they can do. Another test that you can do to see if an organism is, I guess, self-aware is what's called the mirror test.
Okay.
It's one that you might learn about in a psychology class.
Okay.
Because it's kind of a fun one to do with infants. Basically, the idea is you're holding the baby, right? And you're kind of playing with the baby and you sort of sneak a little mark on their forehead or something like that, somewhere that they can't see it or they can't feel it.
All right.
And then you set the kid in front of a mirror. And if they reach out and touch the mirror as if they're interacting with somebody else and sort of try to get at the mark by touching at the mirror, then they don't understand that what they're seeing is themselves.
Okay.
But if you put them in front of a mirror and they look at the mirror and then they reach up and they touch the mark on their forehead, then that's a sign that they understand that this thing in the mirror is themselves.
Mm.
And that even though there's the appearance of this other thing over there, it's actually not truly some other thing. That's me.
Now, I would imagine, though, that like infants, maybe the first time they ever see a mirror, like the more times they see a mirror, the more likely they are to eventually learn.
Yeah, that's probably true. And most kids, if you do this before about a year and a half or so, they interact with that other baby in the mirror as if it's somebody else.
Okay.
And beginning about a year and a half to about 2 years old, that's kind of the time frame when they start understanding that that's themselves.
Well, I mean, I had a dog that up until at least 12 years would always bark at this other dog. It never figured it out.
Yeah, some animals just never figure it out. You can find YouTube videos of animals being terrified by what's in the mirror.
Yeah.
You know, cats behaving ridiculously and everything else. So there are some animals, other non-human animals, that pass the mirror test. So chimps, orangutans, elephants can pass the mirror test.
Because they can remember.
Well, yeah. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but what else? Dolphins pass the mirror test. These have so far all been mammals, but also magpies have been shown to pass the mirror test. It's a really beautiful bird. It's got like a black chest and some nice white and blue patterns on it. And what the researchers did is they put a little dot on their chest, unbeknownst to the bird. And then when the bird was presented with a mirror, it would see that on its chest was this little dot, and it would take its beak and try to like groom itself off. But until it was presented with a mirror, it had no idea that there was this little thing on its feathers. So it's clearly like, oh, that's me. And what the, what? Okay, who put this here? That kind of thing.
Okay.
So if we zoom out and start wondering, okay, well, what about an awareness of what you are aware of?
Oh, wait.
So am I aware of what you are aware of? Can I think about what you are thinking about?
Okay.
And we're starting to get into what's called the theory of mind.
Oh, so we have a colleague named Tom. I thought this was just...
Yes.
I saw this in the notes.
Right.
Like, we're talking about Tom.
We're going to need to talk...
This is where he's stuck.
For quite a while. We're going to need to talk quite a while about Tom. Write to us, Tom. And so this theory of mind, it's the idea that an organism understands that it has its own mental life that is independent and separate from the mental life of other individuals who themselves have their own mental lives. And so I know things that you don't know, and you know things that I don't know, and we behave accordingly. And so one interesting test of this is what's called the false belief test.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of this one? This is another one like from a psychology class.
All right.
So in this one, imagine the scenario that I have a red box and a blue box.
I gotcha.
And you and a friend are standing there, and I have a red box and a blue box.
Okay.
And then I show you a ball. and I put it into the blue box, and then I close the lid.
Yeah.
And then you go out, you leave the room, and while you're gone, I take the ball out of the blue box, and I put it in the red box, and then I close the lid. And then you come back in.
Yeah.
You with me so far?
I think you're about to blow my mind.
Yeah. So if I ask your friend, where is Mike going to look for the ball? What would they say?
Well, I've already forgotten which one is which.
Okay.
So remind me. So we started out, you put it into the red box.
No, I put it in the blue box.
You put it in the blue box. That's what I saw.
That's what you saw. You left the room.
And then I come back. It's actually in the red, but my friend knows that I'm limited in information and would assume it's still in the blue box.
Right.
Got it. Okay. So my friend would say blue box.
Yeah. And congratulations, your friend has theory of mind. They understand that you are holding a false belief.
Ah, okay.
That you have information that is incorrect, that they know to be incorrect, and also that they know that you do not know that it's incorrect.
Okay.
All right. Kids, up until about maybe 4 or 5 or 6, have a really hard time with that. If you were to do that test mm-hmm. with perhaps my 3-year-old, I'm going to go home and try this weekend. She would probably have a hard time saying that you are going to look for the ball in the blue box, right? She's going to be like,
'cause she knows it's in the red one.
Yeah, it's in the red one. Why would he waste his time looking in the blue box?
Right.
That's not where the ball is. It's in the red one.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So she would have a hard time understanding that you have a false belief.
Mm.
Okay? She's getting there, but not quite fully understanding how somebody else could have a separate set of information relative to what she has.
Okay. Right?
By the time the kids are like in first grade or so, they've usually figured this out.
It seems like it'd be later than that because I used to play like hide and go seek with like first grade kids, like nieces and nephews. And they were still terrible even then. It was.
Where did Uncle Mike go? He's disappeared. I don't know. No, I mean, you know, these sorts of things, they vary a lot depending on. It's a big, broad continuum, they kind of start to figure it out by first or second grade, you know, by third or fourth grade. Probably 90% of them have got it by then. Okay, so that's a fun one to do with humans. Can we do that with non-human animals? And I probably wouldn't be bringing it up if we couldn't.
Right. I was like, oh, man, I don't know the answer to that. But because I didn't know the answer.
You have, yeah.
But you're asking me these questions as if...
I knew that you didn't know. So essentially, the same thing kind of experiment was done with orangutans, right? So there's an orangutan sitting in its little enclosure, watching what's going on. We have two different boxes, and then an object gets put into the blue box, and the observer leaves the room, and then the experimenter takes the ball, the object, out of the blue box and puts it in the red box.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person comes back in and they reach for the blue box and kind of try to rattle the lid and try to open the box, but act like, oh, I can't get this open.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of give up. And so then what happens is the orangutan is allowed to assist the person.
Hmm.
And so what they do more often than you would expect just at random is they hand the box to the person that actually has the ball in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the red box, right? If the orangutan was just understood what the person was trying to do as trying to get the box open, then they would have handed them the box that they were trying to get open.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
But they handed them the box with the ball in it. So they had to infer that not just they're trying to get this box open, the orangutan is understanding that your motivation here is to get that object.
Yeah.
Right? So it's actually thinking about what you are thinking about.
Interesting. Okay.
And it knows that you hold a false belief as well, that
you
think that this object is in the wrong, where it actually isn't.
Okay.
So orangutans can pass the false belief test.
Okay.
There's another fun study with chimps.
Okay.
This is one where you have a subordinate individual and a dominant individual. Chimps live in societies with a hierarchy.
Okay.
And the dominant individuals usually kind of get their first pick of food resources to the subordinate ones. Okay, so you have subordinate and dominant individual both looking in on the same arena. And then the experimenter hides a piece of food in there.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them see where it was hidden. And then they close the door so that the dominant individual can no longer see. And then they take the piece of food and they stick it somewhere else that's hidden. And the subordinate individual is watching this the whole time.
Yeah.
Right? And then they open the dominant individual's door again.
Mm-hmm.
and they let both the dominant and the subordinate individuals into the arena.
Mm-hmm.
In those trials where the dominant individual was misinformed about the location of the food,
mm-hmm.
the subordinate individual used that to their advantage to go and get to the food first, because it knew that the dominant individual held this false belief about the location of the food,
mm-hmm.
and used that to its tactical advantage to go and get more food.
That's less convincing to me. That
is it?
Because it knows where the food is. That doesn't necessarily have to involve the dominant one.
But in the trials where the dominant individual saw the food being moved, then the subordinate individual would not get nearly as much of that food.
So they wouldn't do a beeline to it. They would
yeah.
wait a bit for the dominant to
yeah.
get there first.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, so it's more that they would know when the doors are open that they have to back off a little bit, let the dominant in there get in there first. And so they're taking their time because they're expecting the dominant to get over there and then do the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, you're saying that they run over where they can actually get the food because they know the dominant's going to be distracted for a bit.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
The dominant's off on a wild goose chase.
Yeah.
Going after where the food isn't. And so while they know that they're going to be wasting their time over there, subordinate okay. individual sneaks over to where the food actually is.
Okay.
That's kind of fun.
Hmm.
And in the wild, chimps will actually use that kind of ability to know what others know or don't know to do what's called tactical deception.
Okay.
And so if a subordinate individual is kind of getting beaten up on, they'll shriek, and this might call another dominant individual into the fray and kind of break it up or to make it so that the individual that's getting beaten up isn't sort of abused too bad.
Yeah.
When the subordinate individual knows that it has another dominant individual in the area, it actually modifies its vocalizations in a way that make the aggressive behavior seem even more severe than it really is.
And you've got kids. They know how to do this too.
Oh, man. The situation where, you know, if you sneak over on and look at watch your kids playing, maybe they're like might bicker with each other a little bit, but then they get it sorted out and it's fine. But if they know you're there,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden it's like, oh, Dad.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that thing. They, and chimps do that too. They overstate the severity of the aggressive act,
yeah,
which is basically creating a false belief in your brain and manipulating your behavior accordingly, right?
So this is the next step then. So
yeah.
not only can they recognize that there's a false belief,
yeah.
but now they're planting a false belief.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's tactical deception, right?
Hmm.
And then maybe the last one that's fun to think about is the ability to think of oneself at a different point in time, to do a sort of mental time travel and to understand something about what the environment might be like at that point and to behave now in a way that is going to benefit yourself at some future date because you know that you can predict what the environment's going to be like and what you're going to wish you had.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about planning ahead for the future?
Yeah.
Like putting money in your 401k.
Yeah. And so like...
And you could be thrown off because there are animals like squirrels seem to bury acorns all the time.
Yeah.
And ants will store food. But one could also argue like maybe those ants are just like, I'll grab this tomorrow and then they just are always adding to it and forget right. about it.
Some of those behaviors are just innate behaviors that they go and do because their hormone levels and their physiological status basically leads to the demand on their brains that they go and do those things. And they can't not do those things because the drive to go and do those things is so high, right? So in other words, there's not really any awareness or thinking about what are conditions going to be like in, you know, a few days or whatever?
Okay.
And what am I going to wish I had at that point?
Right. Yeah.
There's this really interesting experiment that demonstrates that ability, however, in jays, type of bird.
Mm-hmm.
These researchers kept these jays in, just think of it as sort of like a large rectangular enclosure that you divide roughly into thirds. And there's a food tray in the middle third. And in that food tray are peanuts and kibble.
So kibble just...
Like dog kibble.
Okay.
Two different cacheable kinds of food.
Okay.
And over on the very left side, there's a little area where they can hide food. And over on the very right side, there's a little area where they can hide food.
Mm-hmm.
So some jays, at the end of the day, get attracted over to the left side.
Okay.
And that's where they're stuck overnight. And then that's where they wake up in the morning. And then they are given a breakfast of, say, nothing but kibble.
Okay.
Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So what Jays will do is during the day, they will preferentially cache peanuts over there.
Hmm.
And then conversely, in the opposite side of the room, for the Jays that were sort of shooed over there and then kept over there overnight,
mm-hmm.
the next morning, they would get a breakfast of nothing but peanuts.
Hmm.
And then so during the day, they would preferentially cache kibble.
Hmm.
And so it's as if they pick up on the pattern of, if I'm stuck over on that side, I'm going to get nothing but kibble in the morning. I'm going to wish I had some peanuts.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep some peanuts over here for myself tomorrow morning.
Hmm.
And vice versa. If I'm stuck over here, I know I'm going to get nothing but kibble. I'm going to wish I had some peanuts. So I'm going to cache a bunch of peanuts over on this side, right? I think you can see that's like a different level of thinking about yourself in the future than like a merely a squirrel burying acorns.
Hmm.
So it's like thinking about thinking plus time.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we necessarily solved what consciousness is other than an awareness of being aware, but it's kind of fun to think about.
Yeah, at what point?
Where that pops up.
Yeah. Yeah, because you could draw a line at any one of those spots and be like, well, now you are conscious.
Yeah.
Well, Troy, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, what'd you think about that?
Because I think Troy really liked that.
I think that you think that. And now Troy knows that I think that you think that.
And with that... This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rody Ortega wrote our theme music. If you like this episode or others like it, subscribe to this podcast and you will download it as soon as it is posted. While there, leave a comment and a rating. That will help other people find our podcast. If you want to have us try to tackle your science questions, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. Or contact us on Facebook. Until next time, thanks for listening.